Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event, able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
All right, everyone. We are continuing our coverage here at the Finger Lakes Comic Con, and we're here with the one and only Don Simpson. How are you doing, sir?
Real good, Dave.
And so for those who don't know, you created a very famous comic book in the 80s.
A couple different things. Well, I started with Megaton Man, which is a satirical superhero for Kitchen Sink Press, and I did about 10 issues of that. I took a break, and I did a science fiction epic called Border Worlds, which is being collected by Dover Graphic Novels in August 2017. And then I went back to doing Megaton Man. I did Return of Megaton Man miniseries, and I did a bunch of one-shots. And then I self-published a series called Bizarre Heroes, which featured many of the Megaton Man characters. So I did about 30 or 40 comic books with Megaton Man and his world. And what I read today here at Finger Lakes Comic Con was a chapter from my prose story, which is this new material
based on
the world of Megaton Man.
So, and you had said that you have so many pages written so far. Is that a one-book series that's going to come out, or...?
In 2015, I just had a bunch of ideas for Megaton Man. I started jotting them down, and I wasn't sure if they should take the form of a series of comic books or graphic novels, or... But I knew I had to write all these things out, and I entered the period of plotting and then fleshing out and writing more things. I went back and read all my old comics, which are now 30 years old. I made a bunch of notes, and then I get more ideas. So what I'm planning to do right now, I thought, well, why don't I just try to write a prose novel and just see how far I can go with it. I have plenty of ideas. I have ideas that... would take me more than a lifetime to draw, which is one of the reasons to write them. I might use them up faster if I write them. So we'll see how this one goes. I should have a draft by the end of 2017, certainly.
Cool. And I think there's a pretty fairly loyal fan base for Megaton Man. Is that what made you come back to it, or what really made you come back to it?
Well, no, not really. There's still people, and I saw several fans here this weekend, people that still remember from the 80s and 90s and more recently. But I'm doing it because I still have ideas. I still want to do it. So I've tried to outlast my fans. I've tried to, those pesky fans, they always want more stuff. I think I've gotten them to completely forget who I am now. So now I can safely... get back into it.
Cool. All right, everyone. And what you're about to hear now is Don reading those prose live here at the convention.
Okay, I want to thank Finger Lakes Comic Con for giving me a microphone and actually have a couple people in the audience, along with Rusty Gilligan over there. Hello. Tom and Chris are in from Rochester, Syracuse. Okay. So, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Donald Simpson, and in the 1980s and 1990s, back in the 20th century, I created a series of comics, mostly about a character called Megaton Man and his world. Yeah, thank you for remembering. And I've been working on new stuff. I've done other things with my life. I went back to school and got a PhD in art history, believe it or not, which that and $3 will get me a cup of coffee. But what I'm going to read for you now is a chapter from what I'm calling my young adult prose project. This is, you may recognize some of the situations. This is actually taking place in 1940. This is kind of the birth of the world of Megaton Man, the origin of the Megaverse, you could say, if I can find it. Here it is. It's called 1940, Burly Boy, Girly Man is the name of the title, or the chapter. You'll hear why in just a moment. Okay. Dawn broke over New York City. Fingers of sunlight groped between the towers of the skyline and across the river toward Bayonne, New Jersey, right in your neck of the woods. There's a sleek black Studebaker circled briskly up a graveled path along the waterfront in a cloud of dust, slowing to a halt in front of a red brick building on the promontory of Constable Hook, overlooking the Upper Bay. Its Washington, D.C. license plates marked it as a very important vehicle indeed, dispatched from the War Department for a very special purpose. Two men in topcoats emerged from the left rear of the sedan facing the building. The young man had jet black hair slicked under his fedora. The older gentleman wore round spectacles and a rigid Homburg over his graying hair. His collar was trimmed in fur. He turned and closed the door, motioning the driver on. The two watched the vehicle circle back down the gravel path toward the loading docks, rumbling in the direction it had come. The young man surveyed the horizon across the busy waterway. Upper New York Bay was already working around the clock, supplying the Federal Shipbuilding Yard in Newark Bay to the north and the Brooklyn Navy Yard directly east. Soon, he realized, the port of New York and New Jersey would become an official port of embarkation for millions of U.S. servicemen shipping overseas to fight once more in Europe. Grimly, the two men turned to take in the imposing facade of the red brick building that now stood alone with them atop the promontory. 6 stories tall, somewhat wider and much deeper, it was capped with a hideous, somewhat incongruous Second Empire mansard attic that looked as though it was about ready to fall off. Just below it, in faded paint, appeared the words Bayonne Tapestry Manufactory, established 1876. An abandoned textile mill, the younger man smirked at the older gentleman, complete with bats in a rotting belfry, a bit cloak and dagger even for you guys, Kendall. We've nicknamed it the Doomsday Factory, Glenn, the man in the fur collar replied, producing a pipe from his pocket. Not much to look at from the outside. All the important improvements so far have been within. He lit the pipe and used it to motion his companion toward the delivery entrance around the side of the building. Don't worry, the contractor is planning a coat of stucco for the exterior eventually to give it a more modern look. Although I'll miss that wooden business along the top. He waved his pipe again. Gives it a sense of history, don't you think? A laboratory is a laboratory, Glenn replied, as long as they keep the dust down. Inside, they made their way through a crowded space illuminated by naked light bulbs, past crates and utility shelving, toward a forlorn freight elevator. Glenn was already skeptical concerning the dust. Kendall, the older gentleman, lifted the gate, and the two men stepped onto the lift. Sensing his companion's distrust, Kendall was quick to reassure him. Don't worry, it's already state-of-the-art upstairs. No telling what wonders and monstrosities this place may produce over the next few years. That part I have no doubt, Glenn replied. Grab my water. Kendall lowered the gate and took a puff on his pipe. You've heard the code name Fat Man and Little Boy, I assume. The two competing designs for the atom bomb, said Glenn, in case one proves unworkable. One plutonium, the other uranium. Different trigger mechanisms, too, from what I understand. Exactly, affirmed Kendall. Rumor has it that Oppenheimer wants to take the whole thing out to Nevada so he can work on his suntan, said Glenn. Tell me, is it true they have Teller working in a bunker under some football field in Chicago? Kendall winced. Glad to know our little community can still keep its secrets, he said, pressing the button to activate the carriage. The code name of our little project is Burly Boy and Girly Man. Can you guess our business? The elevator began to slow, clattering its slow, clattering rise. The atomic soldier, Glenn chuckled reflexively. Impossible, at least the way you propose to go about it. But you already know where I stand, Kendall. We're at complete odds on this issue. Not one soldier, both kinds, Glenn, Kendall announced.
Burly Boy, Fission, Girly Man, Fusion. 12 of our best minds have been assembled here exploring each path for the past several weeks. And you need a 13th to break the tie? Glenn stared suspiciously at the man in the fur collar. But I told you, we're in complete disagreement. Your megaton paradigm is built on wildly optimistic assumptions, whereas my meltdown model holds the most promise. You see where this is going. Okay. Not to break a tie, Glenn, said Kendall, puffing professorially on his pipe, to create one. Can I get a chair? So I've set my water down. I appreciate that. Thank you. We will resume in 10 seconds. Please support NPR. All right. Not to break a tie, Glendale, said Ken, or not to break a tie, Glenn, said Kendall, puffing professorially on his pipe, to create one. He looked gravely at the younger man. This matter is too important to be decided by a simple majority. The stakes are far too high. The brightest minds in the scientific community must argue this out and reach the best possible conclusion for the nation, once and for all. We only have the time and resources for one go at this. Once the shooting war starts, it may be too late. All bets are off. We can't afford to get this wrong. The carriage reached the top floor, rattling to a stop. But you said there are 12 here already, said Glenn. I make 13. That doesn't lend itself to a tie. Somebody must be holding out. I think you can guess who. Not Willard, gasped Glenn. Careful, you're talking about the wunderkind of the Burly Boy, Girly Man initiative, Kendall chided. The president personally named him. After making headlines around the world for isolating the mutonium particle, no other choice was possible. Chris is smirking at this. This is deadly serious. No, gasped Glenn again. I know Willard has a certain celebrity cachet, but to head a project of this magnitude... Face it, Glenn, Kendall cautioned as he lifted the gate. Willard Helveticus Brainerd may be erratic, immature, mercurial, but he's also the most brilliant biomolecular nuclear physicist we have. In fact, the term had to be invented just for him. His erudition is so breathtakingly broad, the rest of us are mere myopic specialists by comparison. The two men stepped out of the carriage. Kendall turned to lower the gate. He has no interest in presiding over meetings, of course, he continued, or negotiating political alliances, so naturally administration has fallen to me. He considers the rest of us a bunch of toddlers arguing over mere atomic power for our proposed soldier, while he has already moved on to more cosmic questions. Or so he would like to think, I'm sure, smirked Glenn. Kendall flicked on a light switch. A single bulb illuminated a cramped, cluttered passageway, and Kendall's grave expression. I'm sure you appreciate the tightrope I'm walking, he said. I realize that, Kendall, Glenn said soberly. As the pair strode down the dank corridor, the older gentleman confided, I should warn you, Glenn. We told Wilder he could play with his toys while the rest of us work out the practicalities. You mean he's got that thing in there? Said the younger man, stopping in his tracks. That mutonium particle? Don't worry, Glenn, said Kendall calmly. It's quite inert the way Agnes has it rigged up for him. But you'll never believe the rudimentary tools he's using to prod that thing. You'll see for yourself in a moment. Down the short corridor, stuffed with leaning filing cabinets and sagging shelves of books, the men arrived at a door under another naked light bulb. This will all be cleared out soon, said Kendall, motioning to the shelves as he reached for his keys. We'll be sinking several levels underground for storage, archives, and so on. I'd feel safer if that mutonium particle were below ground, too, mused Glenn, or at the bottom of the ocean. The brightness of the room was dazzling compared to the gloom of the hallway. The two men entered a large space that had been lit by fluorescent lamps throughout the night. This illumination was already surrendering to the skylights that flooded the workshop with a rapidly progressing dawn. A large round table dominated the center of the room, a flattened ring, actually, some 30 feet across and 3 feet thick, with a 24-foot hole in the center. The table surface was strewn with slide rules, notebooks, and charts. Around it swirled busy men and women who had clearly worked through the night, perhaps several consecutive nights, with little sleep. Around the room, empty coffee cups sat on every level surface. Kettles sat unattended on hot plates, their neglected contents boiled away to an acrid tar. Ashtrays and waste baskets overflowed with crumpled refuse of myriad brainstorming sessions. Groups of scientists, sleeves rolled up and ties loosened, clustered mainly around two chalkboards on wheels covered with chemical formulations. Some sat on tall stools while others stood or paced. One regal woman with a cigarette holder sat on an uncomfortable folding chair as if it were a throne. They paid no attention to the new arrivals. In the far corner of the large room, two much younger people, a boy and girl, really, wore aprons and worked quietly among wires and burned-out vacuum tubes over a small workbench. They were soldering together a somewhat imperfectly matched pair of small devices, each with a camera lens on one end and a small cathode ray tube screen on the other, with a parabolic antenna and handle set on tiny legs, looking as if a walkie-talkie and a television set had given birth to a new kind of prototype field communicator. Despite the gravity with which they worked, to Glenn it appeared for all the world as if a couple of his colleagues had not been able to locate babysitters in time to respond to their government summons and had simply brought their young ones along. One other adult, even more oblivious to his surroundings, stood directly in the vast opening at the center of the ringed table. He toiled over a smaller round table. He alone wore a white lab coat, his shock of hair and thick, almost opaque glasses conveying the impression of a mind completely in the clouds. On the smaller table was an anvil and an array of tools, including a simple hammer and chisel, various files and rasps, tweezers, pliers, and a magnifying glass. Also on the table was a wire spool audio recorder with a microphone on a small stand. The rest of the surface was covered in pencils, papers, and a notebook. More writing material spilled onto the floor. There was a stool nearby, but it never occurred to the man to sit down. Hovering in midair, at shoulder height, in the center of the small table, was a white sphere, little bigger than a cue ball. Swirling around it were tiny, colorful, abstract shapes and meaningless symbols that appeared momentarily before fading away, as others appeared. Nothing seemed to be holding the sphere in suspension. Rather, it floated free of gravity of its own accord. "You weren't kidding about Willard," Glenn remarked to Kendall, nodding to the lab-coated scientist and the hovering, billiard-like sphere. "I'm surprised he's not working the thing over with stone knives and hand axes. The least you could do is get him a pool table for that thing." Kendall ignored the remark as he removed his hat and fur-collared topcoat. He smoothed the front of his tweed suit, cleared his throat ostentatiously, and wrung his hands before addressing his colleagues. "Ladies and gentlemen, I think most of you know Glenn Franklin Stevens. He needs no introduction, especially since half of you are elaborating on his theories. But what say we go around the room and introduce ourselves, if only to refresh our acquaintance? You all know me. For the record, I'm Kendall Forrester." No one in the room paused at all in their discussions or activities, or even turned to glance at the man who spoke. Instead, they continued debating, running calculations, making notes, and writing equations on the chalkboards, completely ignoring the newcomers. "I don't think anyone's taking attendance, Kendall," Glenn smirked. "Officially, none of us are even here, right?" Glenn also removed his hat and top coat and hung them on a coat rack. Undaunted, Kendall Forrester motioned him toward the first chalkboard. "These are my people, Glenn. You know Orson Mercury, Elias Tashline, Brenda Marlowe, and of course Agnes Crafton Ingram," he said, by the latter indicating the seated lady with the cigarette holder. "Damn glad," offered Orson with an eager prep school flourish, extending a hand to Glenn. "Let's get this show on the road. His rolled up sleeves and vest gave him the expectant air of a prodigal theater director who sold out opening night performance with a woefully under-rehearsed cast loomed. "Actually, I'm a great admirer of your work," said Elias in a shockingly nasal voice as he gave a convulsive cough. I'm actually supposed to do a Jerry Lewis, Nutty Professor voice there.
"Actually,
I'm a great admirer of your work," he said. His tweed suit and bow tie were powdered in chalk dust, which produced clouds as they shook hands. Brenda Marlowe was tall and lean, her dark hair already turned salt and pepper. She had a preference for slacks with suspenders over pullover sweaters that were a size or two too big. "Sorry for not shaking hands," said Brenda, covering her mouth with her handkerchief. "Feeling a bit under the weather. Would rather not pass along any bug to you. No offense." "None taken," said Glenn. He added, might just be the dust." "Charmed," said Agnes, offering her hand. "Nice to have a good-looking young man among these petrified dinosaurs. And please call me Aggie." Glenn blushed, but noted that nearly all of his colleagues, except Kendall, were about the same age, late 20s or early 30s, even though several seemed much older in terms of academic demeanor. Orson tacked a chart over the scrawled formulas on the chalkboard in a dramatic grand guignol gesture. In the center of the white sheet was a crudely drawn outline of a male figure, the physique appearing more ape-like than human, broad shoulders, massive arms, thin waist, and relatively tiny legs. Around the figure were scribbled notes from several hands, mathematical equations, chemical formulae, even estimated dollar figures. Bold block print across the top read "Burly Boy," and across the bottom "Megaton Soldier." "That's the ticket, Glenn," Orson jabbed the drawing with finality, as if resting his case. "We've got the thing nearly worked out. Molecules basted in an atomic bouillabaisse, saturated with nuclear energy. Massive, almost unlimited power. Could replace entire regiments, battalions, save thousands of lives on the battlefield. And utterly impervious to conventional weapons." Can you visualize this? Okay. "Actually, averred Elias, a protein
preparation is administered prior to the radioactive exposure, emulsifying the musculature."
He swallowed hard, his eyes wide, almost in horror. "Through chemistry, we will in fact..." He halted to clear his throat several times, pushing up the half-moon spectacles on his nose as he did so. "By creating an entirely new race, that is to say." He gulped again apprehensively. "Of mega-humanity, as it were." He is a herky-jerky style of talking. Brenda nervously wiped her brow with her kerchief. "Of course, fusion is the more technically difficult and perhaps unpredictable source of energy in terms of amplifying physical strength," she warned. "We simply won't know what kind of Frankenstein we have on our hands until we attempt it on an actual human subject." Agnes Crafton Ingram gave a knowing smirk. "Don't worry," she intimated to Glenn. "We're nowhere near working out the logistics, despite Orson's boasts. We may be a bit further along than your side, but it's still a coin toss." Pausing to take in the young man with an appraising glance, she added, "I, for one, am still open to changing positions." Glenn blushed. Kendall ushered him over to the second large chalkboard. "And these are your colleagues," he said. "Your old schoolmates, Seymour Starlight, Mercedes Robeson James, Hyacinth Anders Racine Revelle, and, of course, Delbart Yorick Goodman." Everybody on that side has three names. Starlight, an affable and slightly portly professor, winked at Glenn. "Old Skull and Bones, 1926. A couple of cut-ups in those days, Glenn, what?" As the two alumni shook hands, he added, "Great to have you back in the fold." Glenn smiled as they shook hands. A soft-spoken voice said, "I'm glad we finally have the horse's mouth on hand, if that's not mixing metaphors," said Mercedes, a pretty African-American. "Maybe you can settle a bet for us," she said. "Now, about the fissile materials you suggest in your paper..." "We'll have time to crunch the numbers later," C.D. interrupted a more assertive, striking, auburn-haired woman. The poor man just flew clear across the country. You want him jumping right into a theoretical maelstrom? She set down her clipboard to shake Glenn's hand. How is Berkeley, anyway, Dr. Stevens? The roses are beautiful this time of year, Hyacinth, but never as lovely as you. Glenn grasped her hand. Alas, all good appointments must come to an end, thanks to Kendall. He glared briefly at his companion. Somehow I find myself back at Fitz Randolph just down the road this semester. From behind Glenn came an ominous, resonating voice. We could be unleashing forces mankind was never meant to leash in the first place, portended Delbert Yorick Goodman in his usual nearly incomprehensible syntax. His slick-back, longer hair and bottle-bottom glasses gave him the appearance of a slightly disheveled symphony conductor on his day off. Dare we play God with the very molecular structure of life itself? Scientists have these moral conundrums all the time. The smile on Glenn's face faded as he turned away from Hyacinth. If we don't, Del, what about the axis? Which axis would that be? Replied Goodman. Clearing his throat loudly, Starlight flipped the chalkboard over to reveal a white outline drawing of a more classically proportioned, less caricatural male figure. Across the top was written Girly Man, and along the bottom, Meltdown Model. He grabbed a piece of chalk. As you well know, Glenn, your proposal has the virtue of being streamlined, agile, almost foolproof, and utterly invincible, unless the core overheats. He made several strokes on the board, circling formulas and drawing arrows to the figure's midsection, like a coach explaining a play to his team in a locker room. In that case, you're left with nothing but a puddle of protons. He set down the chalk and clapped the dust from his hands. In any case, my calculations back you up. We can bring in an army of such soldiers online within a few short months, striking terror in the hearts of those evildoers, perhaps bringing the war in Europe to an end, even before America has no choice but to get involved. Why, I wouldn't be surprised if the mere rumor of the possibility of such a being as our meltdown man were to cause Hitler's generals to stage a preemptive coup. You won't be able to get a word in edgewise for another 3 hours, Seedy nodded to Glenn, even if it is your own theory. Taking Kendall aside, Glenn whispered, Am I missing something? You said there was a group of 12 already at work here, but I count only 10, including you and Willard. Aren't there supposed to be a couple more? Kendall gestured toward the two young people in the corner, huddled over their strange electronic prototypes. My apologies, Glenn. I forgot to introduce you to our junior colleagues, Rex Rigid and Winnie Wirtz, savants aged 12 and 9, respectively. Wunderkinds, even more wunderkind than Willard? Said Glenn, astonished. Good Lord, I thought they were somebody's kids. Dr. Tashlin may be my uncle, said Winnie, shyly. With her wavy brown hair, large nose, full mouth, and glasses, Glenn now noticed the resemblance. But I take your side, Dr. Stevens. The meltdown model is the only workable path to an atomic soldier. She mildly blushed. Although, frankly, I don't care for all this war stuff. Neither do I, Glenn agreed, smiling. I must side with the megaton paradigm, I'm afraid, Dr. Stevens, Rex said reprovingly, removing a safety glove and wiping his forehead with the back of his bare hand. I mean, since it looks like we've got to fight. The welding goggles that sat perched on his forehead seemed completely superfluous for the work at hand. His shock of dark, curly hair stood almost straight up, and his temples seemed almost prematurely gray. He handed Glenn his small, fat notebook. You'll see I've worked it out already. The other grown-ups would see it, too, if they weren't so threatened by my prodigal genius. Kendall pointed to the pair of electronic devices with his pipe. Winnie and Rex are working on a new communication system of all things, he explained to Glenn. Cross-dimensional, if I follow their line of thinking, and I'm not at all certain that I do. Multi-dimensional transceivers, to be exact, Dr. Forrester, said Winnie. There are nothing novel about the parts. It's all about the wavelength they can transmit and pick up. Of course, as long as both devices inhabit the same dimension, we can't be sure they will work. We'll have to figure out some way of sending one to another reality and calling back in order to find out for sure. Glenn, who had been paging through the notebook as if it were encrypted in Martian, glanced sideways at Kendall. Multi-what? Until then, when he continued, we can only emulate a dimensional bifurcation by creating a slight temporal frequency delay wave. To her young male counterpart, she announced, Rex, I'm taking the device across the room for testing. A what wave? Asked Glenn, now thoroughly boggled. Temporal frequency delay, said Rex curtly, as if talking to an imbecile rather than one of America's preeminent quantum physicists. As I'm sure you know, Dr. Stevens, time travel is intrinsically connected with dimension replication. That being the case, it may be possible to emulate the effect of crossing over into another dimension merely by chronometrically offsetting the two devices by a fraction of a light second. Glenn looked quizzically at Kendall. This is their diversion? They have shorter attention spans, naturally, Kendall explained, so we have to keep them occupied with something fun. But rest assured, the Megaton meltdown question is burbling in the backs of their minds whilst their conscious attention is concentrated on more trivial puzzles in the meantime. Of that I have no doubt, said Glenn, closing the cover of the notebook. Well then, I suggest we take a head count, offered Seymour Starlight in a voice loud enough for everyone in the room to hear. Megaton or meltdown? Where do we stand? Finally, the room grew silent. Glenn looked apprehensively about. All in favor of Burly Boy, the Megaton paradigm. One by one, the hands of his colleagues, Kendall Forrester, Orson Mercury, Elias Tashlin, Brenda Marlowe, and Agnes Crafton Ingram went up. Flamboyantly, Rex Ridge's hand joined theirs. Burly Man, the meltdown model, said Seymour. He raised his own hand and was joined by Mercedes Robeson-James, Hyacinth Anders Racine Revell, and Delbert Yorick Goodman. Shyly, Winnie Wirtz raised her hand. Glenn joined them. The hands for the Megaton paradigm totaled six. The hands for the meltdown model also totaled six. A stalemate, said Agnes. We're finally making progress. Willard, the figure in the lab coat in the middle of the ring table, continued to work, ignoring the vote. Six and six with one abstention, said Glenn. Now I know how John Adams felt at the Second Continental Congress. We should be off sync now by a 16th of a second, Winnie called out to Rex from her new position on the opposite side of the room. She had set her device on an abandoned stool and positioned herself in front of its camera lens. She had also connected a small telegraph key to the device, which she tapped. I'm sending you Morse code, Rex, as well as a video image. See if you can pick them up. Rex adjusted his device with a screwdriver. Your image is coming in a bit garbled. Adjusting the timing. What about Willard, said Glenn to Kendall, taking off his jacket and rolling up his sleeves. Certainly he's voiced some opinion on the matter. We have to handle him with kid gloves, even more so than the youngsters, Kendall sighed. He tapped his pipe on the large ring-shaped table. I had this custom-built to facilitate face-to-face discussion, but we've yet to all sit around the table at once. We immediately fell into factions, and Willard got so fed up with our petty bickering, he decided to crawl under and set up shop right in the middle of it. He nodded toward the floating white sphere with shapes and symbols slowly swirling about it. He's managed to block out everything else, engrossed in that cosmic cue ball of his ever since. The scientist in the lab coat in the center of the ring table was just finishing jotting down a note. He leaned over into the microphone connected to the wire recorder, preparing the mutonium particle for the next battery of tests, dictated Willard. This was the first sound he had uttered since Glenn and Kendall had arrived. We're going to tickle the dragon's tail. His great contribution to the war effort, remarked Brenda. So the only thing we actually agree on, said Glenn, returning to the subject, is that we disagree. But why can't we pursue both Burly Boy and Girly Man?
Why can't we pursue both, Burly Boy and Girly Man? Del grew ashen. Even one atomic soldier is to risk the apocalypse, he intoned. Pursuing both experiments at one and the same time is unthinkable. We have no idea how they might interact. An uncontrolled chain reaction could destroy the entire planet. Don't be so dramatic, Del, said Agnes. We're talking about two atomic soldiers, one impossibly unwieldy, the other lithe and agile. Not matter versus antimatter. We don't know that for sure, said Del. What if they didn't take a liking to one another, asked C.D.? They'd be so evenly matched. Burly Boy and Girly Man could start their own Armageddon, and who's to stop them? You're supposing the United States has sufficient resources to fund both Megaton Paradigm and Meltdown Model, said Kendall. But sadly, or happily, it does not. There's a war on, you know. Not yet, perhaps, said Hyacinth, but it's in the offing. The sooner America gets involved, the better, said Elias Tashlin. He was looking over his niece's shoulder, intently studying the strange device she had brought over to his side of the room. The ahem camps are already a fact. He put a protective arm around Winnie. News from the old country grows worse by the day. Assuming the government could fund both initiatives, Orson interjected, they would have to be pursued on practically different planets. It's the only prudent course. At the very least, we'd have to build a partition, a firewall, added Hyacinth, before we could safely undertake both experiments at the same time. Perhaps we could use some of Agnes' precious extanium. All the extanium known to exist is already in this room, noted Agnes, gesturing toward the floating white sphere in the center of the ring table with her cigarette holder. The minute quantity we've been able to extract from stray meteorites is encasing Willard's even more precious mutonium particle. To create a buffer between the Meltdown and Megaton projects, offered Seymour professorially, we'd need a shield of extanium as wide as the rings of Saturn, a solid disk bisecting the whole planet, which of course is impractical. We're considering the practical, said Brenda Riley. Somebody please make a note of the date and time. C.D. interjected, if we had that much extanium, we could just as easily partition off Hitler and Tojo from the free world, thus precluding another great war altogether. So we're back to square one, concluded Kendall. Since we can't conduct both the Burly Man and Girly Boy experiments at the same time in the same place, we're simply going to have to choose. Anyone have a coin to toss? Quipped Brenda, searching her trouser pockets. I'm plug out of nickels. Her colleagues broke into polite laughter. Are you getting anything, Rex? Winnie called out, tapping her device with her fingernail. I've shifted to 1/32nd of a second. Still a very garbled graphic transmission, said Rex, flipping a toggle. Let me try a binary phase shift. The two teams of adults huddled once more around their respective chalkboards. Glenn handed the fat notebook of Rex Rigid he still carried to Elias Tashlin, who inspected it even more intently than he had his niece's device. Dr. Willard Brainerd put on thick rubber gloves, adjusted his thick glasses, and tenderly grasped for the floating orb. He gently maneuvered it closer into his field of vision. The abstract shapes and symbols faded and disappeared. The extanium sphere, rotating his fingers in opposing directions, the extanium sphere divided cleanly into two halves. In the center, a tiny white dot glowed intensely. Removing his fingers from the hemispheres, the halves remained floating in place, all three objects hovering in midair in front of Willard like an exploded view diagram. I've exposed the mutonium particle, Willard dictated into the microphone. At this point, the risk is minimal. Taking a pair of tweezers from his array of tools, he carefully pinched the tiny glow of light, gently lowering the all but invisible particle onto the anvil that was positioned waist high. About to administer stress test, Willard recorded. You can feel the tension rising in the room.
cosmic cue ball has been separated. The Mutonium particle is out. Picking up a hammer and chisel, Willard took a deep breath. Suddenly and violently, he took a wild swing. Clang! Of all his colleagues on the top floor of the Doomsday Factory, under the skylight revealing the ever-progressing morning light, only Glenn turned to look. Setting down the hammer and chisel, Willard picked up a small Geiger counter. He grimaced as he read the dial. "Oh, no," he whispered hoarsely. "What is it, Willard?" Glenn asked. He took a step toward the ring table, leaning toward the center where his colleague stood over the anvil. Glenn, Willard turned to the newcomer, embarrassed. "I didn't even realize you were here. When did you..." He squinted as he looked around the room. It seemed to him as if the laboratory outside the perimeter of the ring table had just suddenly materialized. "Over an hour ago by now," said Glenn, looking at his watch. "You said, oh no, just now. Is anything wrong with the mutonium particle?" "Oh," said Willard, brushing back his wild hair. "I was just trying to, you know..." "Trying to do what exactly, Willard?" said Glenn impatiently. "Trying to, split it," Willard explained matter-of-factly. I seem to have failed." For a moment, Glenn pondered the ramifications of attempting to split a dangerous radioactive particle without warning in a room full of unprotected scientists. "Well, a negative result." Willard's shoulders suddenly slumped in defeat. He began to shudder. "Father always said I'd never make it as a quantum mechanic." I wouldn't take it so hard," encouraged Glenn. "After all, if at first you don't succeed..." "You don't understand, Glenn. I think I may have accomplished something else." Glenn leaned over the ring table. "Like what?" Willard gulped. "Instead of splitting the particle, I may have severed the reality envelope surrounding it." He glanced down at the Geiger counter again. "In fact, I'm pretty sure that's what I've done." "How's that?" Glenn cocked an ear. Willard leaned over into the microphone. "I believe I've split the universe," he said, the machine amplifying his voice, "in two." The other grown-up scientists around the two chalkboards abruptly turned their attention to the center of the room, silent. Meredith's eyes looked up toward the skylights now flooding the room in early morning light. "The universe seems intact to me." "Yes," Willard agreed, "and for the next few moments that illusion will persist." "Willard, confound it," Orson ejaculated, slamming down his clipboard on a stool. "What the hell are you talking about?" "Instead of splitting his precious mutonium particle," offered Hyacinth, "Willard is claiming he somehow split all of time and space around it." "Exactly, Dr. Racine Raphael," said Willard. "From this moment on, from this center point out, two completely different realities are already beginning to diverge from one another." "With a hammer and chisel?" Del protested. "Now I'm getting something," announced Rex, monitoring his device. "It's a message. It says, I think Dr. Stevens is cute." On the other side of the room, Winnie turned a bright red scarlet. "You weren't supposed to read that out loud." "The field of temporal distortion Winnie and Rex created with their devices," CD offered, a glimmer of comprehension emerging in her eyes. "Just as Willard struck the particle, in theory that might have been sufficient to..." "Such speculation hardly matters now," declared Kendall. "If what Willard says is true..." "Can't you just put the particle back in its casing?" Seymour demanded. "Oh, yes," said Willard, jolted from his musings, picking the particle up with the tweezers and positioning it between the Extanium hemispheres. He brought the two halves back together. A solid white sphere, once more, the abstract shapes and symbols reappeared and resumed their dance. "There." "Whew," said Seymour, mopping his brow. "But that won't make any difference now," Willard intoned. "It's too late." Elias Tashlin, scribbling on one of the blackboards,
dropped his chalk, struck by a sudden realization. Quantum decoherence, he coughed and swallowed hard, as it were. Exactly, Willard declared, slowly walking around the circle within the confines of the ring table. As he paced, his hands moved from being clasped behind his back to gesturing vaguely in the air, as if he were addressing a packed lecture auditorium. Outside the walls of this doomsday factory, he orated, are two inceptually identical but rapidly variegating dimensions, one superimposed upon and imbricated with the other. In the first is the same greater New York City we left behind when we entered this building days, weeks ago. In the second is a vast eastern megatropolis overlaying and, for the moment at least, indistinguishable from the first. Willard stopped and looked gravely at his surrounding colleagues. But despite appearances, these two realities have already come untethered from one another and are flying off into parallel and altogether incompatible dimensions, worlds that will soon grow completely unrecognizable to one another. You're talking nonsense, old boy, said Orson Mercury nervously. There's no evidence. You'll have all the evidence you require shortly, Willard continued calmly. Dissimulation has already begun. Soon the histories of New York and Megatropolis, shall we say, will no longer be reconcilable. As the two dimensions careen headlong toward inevitably separate, mutually exclusive futures. If that is the case, demanded Seymour, then why on earth isn't it starting here in this room inside the laboratory? For the moment, the Doomsday Factory is a pocket universe, Glenn reasoned, the inside out of Schrödinger's box. Exactly, confirmed Willard. We have yet to be claimed by one or the other reality. But the center cannot hold. The gyre inevitably widens. Or contracts, as it were, said Elias. The ring table began to vibrate. Soon this pocket reality will collapse, Willard continued. Each of us will have to decide which dimension to cling to and which history to become entangled. All this in World War II, said Brenda. You're right, declaimed Kendall. My God, this jeopardizes our entire project. Burly boy and girly man are doomed. And with it, our best chance to prevent a global war. Nonsense. It's a stroke of luck, said Agnes cheerfully. Willard has unwittingly provided the very answer to our dilemma. Confound it, Agnes, Orson blurted out. What in heaven's name can you mean? We're all about to be snuffed out of existence forever, along with America's only hope of building any sort of nuclear-powered hero, be it Megaton or Meltdown. But don't you see, said Agnes calmly, the exact opposite is true. Our hopes have now been doubled. How do you figure, Aggie, said Glenn. A moment ago, Glenn, we all agreed that pursuing both the Megaton paradigm and the Meltdown model at one and the same time was too risky in the same reality. Seymour snapped his fingers. By God, she's right. We now have two dimensions available to us, enabling each group to pursue their research separately without fear of conflict with the other, and the full resources of the federal government in each. Brilliant, Brainerd. Suddenly a crack formed on both sides of the ring table. The whole building began to rumble violently. Each group must choose sides now, shouted Willard. Only seconds to go. Wait, protested Rex, who was nearer the Meltdown scientists. I'm on the wrong side of the room. I want to be on the Megaton team. It's half my theory at this point. So am I, realized Wendy, but I promised Mom when she died I'd stick with my uncle. Sorry, Dr. Stevens. Good luck with the Meltdown model. You're on the right track. Rex realized that Winnie's uncle, Elias Tashlin, still possessed his notebook. He screamed, Megaton Man is my intellectual property, you dirty so-and-so. But the now thundering vibrations coursing through the building were drowning him out. The table cracked completely and cleanly into two semicircles. On each end of the room, five adults and a child
clutching a multidimensional transceiver, huddled around their respective chalkboards. From the perspective of the other, each group began to fade from view. Only Willard Helvetica's Brainerd and his floating white orb appeared to remain solid in the center of the ring table. "Remember our theorem," shouted Winnie. "Time travel is multidimensional." "Don't go quoting us to me," snarled Rex, "and don't try trademarking any of those distinct phrases in your dimension." Winnie, Rex, and their respective colleagues finally disappeared to one another completely. "Turning and turning," quoted Willard to himself, alone now with the white orb as all around them ebbs in nothingness. "Things fall apart. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world." Suddenly the rumbling subsided, and all was enshrouded in darkness, except for the cosmic cue ball, the only remaining source of light. Fields of stars now appeared, then planets and moons, comets and asteroids, all swirling madly about the free-floating Willard and his particle. "Come here, you little rascal," the harried scientist shouted at the floating sphere, grabbing at it in futility. Finally, he and it were swallowed by the gaping void. Thank you. So I only have like 3 hours for questions. And thanks to the superhero guys, the blog that will be posting this, Dave. Did you recognize anything from that? I've got a couple people in the audience that read the comics from the 80s. Few references. Now go back and read those comics. You'll be like, wow, there's a whole... This is all new stuff. But what I did in the spring of 2015, I realized I had a lot of ideas for new Megaton Man stuff. And I went back and I read all my old comics and I made notes and I started asking these questions like, well, how did this, why do we have two universes? Why do we have basically a Marvel and a DC universe? How did they come together and how did they split apart? So that's kind of the foundational origin. And in the story, we will follow both tracks, and we will learn how they learn to cross over, and then how they fuse back together, you know, into a fiasco verse type thing. There's only about a zillion characters. I don't know if you could follow all the scientists. Maybe I'll need to draw it. I don't know. We'll see. All right. Well, I don't know when the next program is, but we'll just surrender the microphone, and I want to thank Dave again for recording and sitting through the whole thing. All right.